So much of my music is bucolic, you know, and sunshine and cornbread and eggs and bacon for breakfast. And but sometimes I like to go to the darker things and try to explore those.
You'll hear both sides of composer Rick Soash on a new recording called Seasonal Breezes, which features five chamber works by the composer. He's written over 400 works, and he told me recently in our conversation that he hasn't been composing for about 8 years now. Instead, he's been focusing on his work as an author. You'll find out about all that and much more about Rick Soash on this edition of New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. I'm Julie Almacher. To ask you about your name, Soash, because I know it has French origins that mean wild or untamed, and that's something that really resonates with you.
Yes, I'm proud of my French ancestry, and Sauvage is the origin of my name. It means wild in the sense of undomesticated. It doesn't have the brutal connotations that savage has in English. So, for example, wild mushrooms are champignon sauvage. And I've always liked that notion that I'm a sort of a man of nature, you know, an homme sauvage.
Well, and I know that made me think of your, is it the Dawswood suite that you did when you were an artist in residence, which definitely is just so beautiful because it takes us right into the realm of nature.
Thank you. I'm glad you think so. That was my intent. I've been inspired by nature all my life, not only musically, but daily, just watching clouds and tree limbs moving in the wind. And it can't help but influence my music, my art.
Rick, I know something else that's really important to you when you are working both on your music and when you're writing is regionalism. Can you talk a little bit about how that provides an access point to invite people in, especially to classical music?
I decided as a young man that I would in many ways emulate Charles Ives. Charles Ives took the Connecticut that he knew as a young boy and as a young man and tried to express it musically. And I thought, I'll try to do that with Ohio. I'm a lifelong resident of Ohio. I grew up in the rural part of north central Ohio. And I asked myself as a young artist, how would one express this part of the world? What would that music sound like? What would it be like? Specifically, what chords and what would the shape of the melodies be? And I found that to be a tremendously inspiring opening, beginning of my trajectory as a composer. Now, I didn't have any examples to look at. There was just nobody else that I know of that's ever tried seriously to address what Ohio sounds like in a piece of classical music. So I drew inspiration from literature. I read the books of the great Midwestern writers, not only from Ohio, but like Willa Cather, for example. And I try to see how they caught in the rhythms of their prose and in their choice of imagery, how they expressed who they were and where they were. And then I tried to translate that into my own music. And that was a tremendous beginning and inspiration and opening for me. However, I wrote music for 50 years. And after a couple of decades as being a regionalist composer, I began to develop other approaches to music. So I found it superb as a beginning point. And I would suggest to any young artist, look around right where you are and try to see how you could express that place in your art.
I'm intrigued by the fact that you started composing when you were quite small, thanks to your mom. And then you also had two pretty remarkable music teachers at a little rural school in Lexington, Ohio. Could you tell me a little bit about Mr. Evans?
And there's also Mr. Dunlap, and they were very, very important for me. In the seventh grade, I was sitting playing the piano in general music class before the class began, just noodling around, having fun, and Mr. Evans said, "What's that you've been playing?" I said, "Oh, it's just stuff that I make up." And he said, "You should write a piece for the choir. You know, we're going to do a spring concert, and you could write a piece." And I said, "Well, I don't know how to write music down. I wouldn't know how to do that." And he said, "Well, I'll show you. It's not that hard. You can do it." I said, "Well, I don't know what to do first." And he said, "Well, come back with three or four notes that you like, and let's see what we can do with them." Well, he coaxed me along and got me to write an Alleluia. He said, "It's just four notes, Alleluia, and we can develop that." And so I came back with four notes, and he showed me how to do those four notes a step higher or a step lower and make a little sequence, and then how to make that build into a phrase. And anyway, I wrote this Alleluia in the seventh grade, and sure enough, it was distributed to the choristers on mimeograph paper. Remember that? And we stood and sang the piece in the spring concert, and my parents clapped, and the audience clapped, and I felt so proud and happy, and I said, "I'm going to write another piece, Mr. Evans," and I did. And then Mr. Dunlap, the band director, he heard about this kid over in choir writing pieces. He said, "Why aren't you in the band?" I said, "Well, I play the piano, but I..." He said, "Well, you should be in the band, and you should write us a march." So he got me playing the drums, and I wrote a march for the band. He helped me figure out the B-flat clarinets and the E-flat alto saxophones and all this. And, well, after that, I was just rolling along. And I stuck close to those gentlemen, both of them, all through my high school years, and I wrote a lot of music with their tutelage and technical support, and then they would get it performed. And I found it immensely satisfying, and that was the springboard which made me into a composer.
And you've also developed and practiced kind of an unusual policy for the past decade or so of giving away your life's work to the greatest extent possible to whomever might be interested in discovering it. Why did you decide to do that?
Well, when I set down my composing pen about 8 years ago, because I felt that I'd said what I had to say, I wanted to address myself, my remaining creative energies, to the challenge of getting my work out there where people can hear it. And there's a very powerful analogy I'd like to share with you about this. Suppose you and I are standing together in front of a bramble, and I pick a blackberry, and I pop it in my mouth, and I eat it, and it's delicious. It's good. It's warm. It's juicy. It's a blackberry. Now, suppose I pick a blackberry, and I turn to you, and I say, "I'll sell this blackberry to you for a dollar." Well, as soon as I say that, it changes, actually, in a spiritual sense, what the blackberry is. And it changes also my relationship with you, because you just saw me pluck it for free off the bush. Well, every musical idea I've ever had came to me for free. I never paid a nickel for any of my ideas. So for me to turn around and try to sell something that I got for free seems immoral and unjust. I mean, and also it seems to me that our country, our world, is so greedy and so based on money and money grubbing and the adoration of billionaires, and I loathe all that. Now, music itself has always been free. You know, what we have paid for traditionally is like the paper and the ink that the score is printed on, or we pay for the disc that on which the music is recorded, or we pay for admission into a concert hall where it's going to be played. But the music itself has always been free, and it always will be. The music itself. It seems to me, philosophically, that given that, it should just be shared. Now, of course, we need to make a life for ourselves in which we can do our art, and that involves earning enough money to live. But there's lots of ways to earn money. It doesn't have to all, or even any of it, have to arise up out of the creative work that we do. So I resolved to give away my work to the greatest extent possible. So, and in this time that we live in, which is extraordinary in this respect, we can do this and it won't cost us anything. I can send out, and I do almost every day, PDFs of my scores to anybody that wants to play them. And I send out MP3s of my music to anybody that wants to hear them. I send them a link where they can hear an MP3, or I send the MP3 itself. And, you know, the internet has made this possible in a way that was not possible earlier. However, there's a tradition here. You know, Walt Whitman printed up Leaves of Grass in its first edition and handed them out for free to people that he thought might like to read them. And Charles Ives did that, too, with his music. He was, of course, a millionaire. But neither of those fellows had access to the internet. Well, today we do. I have a thing I do. Every Sunday morning, I send out an email to a base of fans and friends, which includes links to a piece of music and also a link to a PDF of the score where they can both hear it and see it if they want. And then I also write an essay or a vignette or a story that comments on the piece. And this is something that anybody can subscribe to or unsubscribe if they get tired of it. And I've been doing this for the past 6 or 7 years, and it's been immensely satisfying. I can't tell you what a joy it is to harvest your own work and then pass it around the table. You know, I picture great bowls and platters of steaming food that all my friends and fans are gathered at this big table, and they were sharing it. You know, it's wonderful. It's wonderful for me. I don't deplore or decry other artists who do make a profit out of their work. Fine, more power to them if that's what they want to do. I did it myself for 50 years. But in the last decade, I've come to find deep joy in sharing my work with anybody that's interested.
I know that you've always wanted to write music that you say your grandmother
yes.
would like. Why is that?
Well, because she was a loving, lovely, simple woman. It had no more education than a high school education, and she was born about 1890, and I felt that if I could write music that Grandma would like, that Grandma would nod her head and say, yes, oh, this is sweet. Oh, I like this. It's lovely. Then I would be true to myself. I'd be true to my origins, as opposed to, say, writing music that a New York Times critic might enjoy or admire, you know, or music that might please a professor when I was in college, or music that might in some way line up with an intellectual assessment of what music is. That's not for me. I want to write authentic music that really comes up out of who I really am. And Grandma, even though she's been gone for 35 or 40 years, is still a kind of an arbiter for me. I still think of it in those terms. Now, you know, I might push Grandma a little bit sometimes, but she's listening.
Most of the music that you compose is written for particular performers, and that is the case for the chamber works that appear in your recording Seasonal Breezes.
When you write a piece of music, I did not just sit and think abstractly, well, maybe I'll write a string quartet today. I almost always had a specific musician in mind, and I would think of that musician's personality, the kind of gestures they make musically and also even with their hands, and the kinds of jokes they laugh at and the kinds of things that turn them serious again and awaken their philosophy or their soul, and then I try to think, what would they most like to bring to an audience, you know, and those kinds of questions are just as inspiring to me as the regionalism that you mentioned earlier. In fact, that's where I moved toward writing for specific musicians and their personalities. In some respects, those pieces are a portrait of those musicians. I'd like to say something about the sonata on that Seasonal Breezes CD. The sonata, I think, is the strongest piece artistically, one of maybe a dozen pieces I've written out of some 400 that I would dare call a masterwork. I think it's just a superb cello sonata. I really do. And yet I think it will probably get a lot less airtime on radio stations than the other works on the CD, and for a very simple reason. The title, Sonata for Cello and Piano, there's no entree in that title. for a music broadcaster to say, well, this would be a good piece to play today. I was a radio broadcaster myself, and I know how radio broadcasters think. And so I've made a real effort over my career to devise titles, and not in a pandering way, but in an authentic way, devise titles that will give broadcasters an opening. Now, why didn't I do that for the cello sonata? I could have called it Pacific Sunset or something like that. Well, first, it would have been inauthentic. It's not about a Pacific Sunset. It's not about anything. It's about music, pure music. And sometimes I like to write pieces that are not programmatic, that simply are saying in their title, this music, I believe, is worth hearing, even if you don't bring to it any particular imagery on your own. Now, of course, people will still bring imagery to hearing a piece of music. I have to tell you a funny little story. I was at a concert of my music, and afterwards a lady came up to me at the reception, and the piece had been played. I don't remember what it was, but it didn't have a programmatic title. And she said, you know, I especially like the part where the squirrels are playing in the leaves. I thought, what? The squirrels are playing in the leaves? And, well, to her, that was, actually, I could see my grandma saying that. To her, that was what was happening in that one part of the music that she really liked, you know. So even with a title that is not programmatic, listeners will still, many of them, will still bring imagery to the experience of listening.
Well, it sounds like she was channeling your grandma there.
Maybe so.
Well, what about Dark Forest? This is a work that you wrote for Josh Airey, the cellist. And it was inspired by a Russian proverb. Can you share maybe a little bit of that proverb and how it's represented?
Yeah, so the proverb is short. It's, the heart of another is a dark forest. I love that. It's, for one thing, it's very Russian. I like the dark feeling of that. But it's really true. It speaks to the isolation of human beings from one another, that even the people to whom we are most close, and by the way, today is the 47th anniversary of my wedding. I've been married to my good lady for 47 years. Even she, and even I, to her, our hearts are a dark forest. We can't really see very far into one another's hearts. And if this is true of a 47-year-old marriage, how much truer is it of all of our other relationships? So Dark Forest explores that, explores the darker side. So much of my music is bucolic, you know, and sunshine and cornbread and eggs and bacon for breakfast. And but sometimes I like to go to the darker things and try to explore those. And Josh Airey, the cellist, he really responded to that. You know, the cello is a dark instrument. The cello is a dark forest. It sounds dark. It's beautiful. But a dark forest is beautiful too, but it's dark. Also, there's another association that's fun to share. The beginning of a great story by the Brothers Grimm, Iron John. There was a king who lived in a castle near a dark forest. And as soon as you hear that opening line, you say, ooh, a dark forest. I want to know more about that dark forest. And sure enough, the story delivers. So I hope the title, you see, Dark Forest, invites people to come in to the world of that music with a certain predisposition, a certain preview, in a way, of what this might be like. And then I hope I can deliver that.
The recording sessions for this CD happened in Duluth, Minnesota, and also in Plymouth, Michigan. Why those locations?
Well, I don't have anything to do with recording my music. The musicians can record it wherever they like. I don't attend. I don't come to the rehearsals. I don't come to the recording sessions because I have nothing to say. I have nothing to add. I can't guide them. I learned this the hard way over a long career. I used to think when I was a young composer that I alone knew best how my music should be played. And I thought it was my duty to impose or even inflict my opinions onto the musicians and make them play it the way I thought it should go. But then I heard musicians who had prepared performances of my music that I had had no input into, and they were so much better than the ones that I had supervised. So I gradually realized that I am not an interpretive artist. I'm a creative artist. I create it. But I am not. I don't have gifts as an interpretive artist. I'm really not a musician. I don't really play. I mean, I sing in a church choir and I can slap a piano around, but I am not a musician. I tell people I'm not a musician. I'm a composer. It's a different thing. And so the musicians, they take my music and they make of it what they will. I've occasionally had musicians say, well, do you want it this way? Blah, 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 or you want it this way? Blah, 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 blah. And I can't hear the difference. I just say, just make it sound good. I don't know. Don't ask me. I don't know how to play a violin or a cello or a clarinet. So I have no business in the recording studio. And the recordings happen completely remote from me. I don't do supervised recordings of my music.
That is a great answer. I know we need to wrap up, so my final question is, what else do you have in the works? I know you're working on another book.
Yes, I'm not writing music anymore, but I have been pouring myself into writing. I love writing words and stories. I mentioned earlier my weekly emails. I put a lot of time into those. They're essays. I'm preparing a series of volumes that will be collected, my collected humorous writings. I've done a lot of humorous writing, and I love that. It's very satisfying to bring smiles into a sad world. I am writing a new book right now, which is simply a little history of the school where I teach and has a remarkable backstory and an interesting founder. And that's a story for a little humble audience of that particular school's community. But my humorous works will be addressed to a broader audience. And I will make every effort, by the way, to give all this away for free as well. It'll be all available on PDFs for free to anybody that's interested in it. Now, obviously, if someone wants a physical book to hold in their hands, then I have to print it. It has to be created. It has to be, you know, paper and bound and ink and all that. And I have to charge for that. I can't totally just give that away. But I usually just charge whatever somebody can afford to pay. And I have found that people will often pay more than I would have even asked if I had put a price on it.
Rick Soash sharing the fruits of his labor on this week's edition of New Classical Tracks from American Public Media, with special thanks to Valerie Kaler for producing this episode. If you're enjoying New Classical Tracks, the absolute best thing you can do for the show is to tell somebody about it. Help spread the word and take a moment to rate and review us on your podcasting app. I'm Julie Albacher.